This is the AMPIC Cyber Critical Assets Podcast. Each episode, we cover important OT and ICS security topics with an eye toward standards and regulation to keep you ahead of your adversaries and your auditors. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Critical Assets Podcast. I am Patrick Miller, and with me today, I have Leslie Carhart, also known as Hacks for Pancakes, and I am just thrilled to have you on. I've got so many questions. I'm so interested in what you're doing. And let's just start by, tell us a little bit about yourself for the audience that doesn't already know who you are.
Hi, everybody. My name is Leslie Carhart, and thank you for having me, Patrick. It's nice to be here. I am a OT cybersecurity professional. I've been doing that for quite a long time. Specifically, I work for a company called Dragos. And at Dragos, we specialize in industrial and critical infrastructure cybersecurity. And I work specifically there in incident response and digital forensics for systems like power plants and mines and transportation that have been compromised by various types of adversary groups.
Awesome. So keeping the people safe from the big machines.
I'm certainly trying to do that. That's important to me.
Fantastic. Well, on that same thread, so these systems are definitely different than IT, right? They're very different. What are some of the unique challenges for incident response and forensics in OT generally? Like, can you do the same things that you would do in IT in the OT world? And if not, why?
Incident response is stunningly different in OT. Yes, we use some of the same forensic tools to do investigations of malware and compromises and computers and things like that. But there's some things that just make it a completely different way of life. The first one, of course, is process consequences. Everything, when you're talking about physical kinetic systems like industrial control systems, you're talking about things that can kill people. They can cause critical services to fail if they aren't there, like water, power, things like that. They can also harm operators. They can cause environmental damage, facility damage. They do physical stuff in the real world. So everything that we do in cybersecurity and OT, we have to do with these process consequences in mind. And so when you're talking about a system that's been compromised, there's a whole bunch of extra considerations that go into the response and recovery efforts, like how long can the system be down without people dying? How long can we operate on manual operations without any of the computers before things start failing? And then there's the side of the investigation too. What tools can I safely run on these computers that aren't going to cause a worse consequence? You're not going to find EDR or XDR on a bunch of industrial hosts. You just can't do that on a lot of vendor and older hosts. Even on newer hosts, they have to operate in a very structured, vendor-approved way to operate safely. So limited security tooling, and oftentimes very old systems with very, very legacy security tooling, and the forensics tools we have to use in those hosts are very old as well. If we're talking about Windows XP or older Windows 95, I see on a routine basis Windows NT. So old school forensics, sometimes very manual forensics, and then very judicious risk decisions about what we can and can't do and how much time we actually have to do those forensics efforts.
What do you mean by time? So talk to me about that.
Sure. So everything in a process, when you're talking about business continuity and process operations, everything comes down to time. Time of how fast the process functions, how many widgets you produce, how much power you put out per minute, per hour, per day, et cetera. And that ties into your bottom line of whether you can stay in business or not. And then time in terms of how long you can safely run without your computers. The computers that I'm talking about, the industrial control digital systems I'm talking about, are things that provide telemetry, so making sure systems are operating safely and effectively and efficiently. They provide process efficiency. And a lot of human beings have been removed from the mix in a lot of process environments. And their roles of keeping things running smoothly have been replaced by computers. So switching back to manual operations is a big deal. And then even more beyond that, some things like modern microgrids and smart grids are so complicated and mathematically complex that they have to be run long-term by computers. So there's the time frame there of how long can we have these systems down, pulling images from them, investigating who's compromised them, figuring out what they did. How long before we just have to start swapping things out with an adversary still in the system to keep people alive? Everything comes down to these time and risk decisions in our investigations.
Okay, and in some cases, I assume there are even situations where you just can't take them down, right? You're gonna, you have to do this in a live operating environment.
I mean, there's a lot of it depends in what I tell customers when they call me in on what's usually their worst day ever. And that comes down to what do you need? Do you need to be up and running in 2 hours? Or somebody dies, or you go out of business. Can we spend 24 hours doing an investigation? Things like that. Those are tough conversations. And you know, in talking about these immature environments where there's less logging and very old systems that have less forensic detail, all those things play into how much I can actually say about what the adversary did. Oftentimes, these incidents in these more legacy and less defended environments are detected very, very late. I'm talking about months or years after the initial intrusion. So I do my best. I have to use a lot of manual, very advanced, old school forensics to pull things out of the ether to try to tell people what the root cause was in the initial point of intrusion. And sometimes I can't. Sometimes it was too long ago. Sometimes we just have to get things up and running. And I collect the forensic evidence I can to do a very manual investigation on after the system's been restored. And that's a very hard decision to make because, you know, you start restoring things on a system that, say, a state adversary or a criminal adversary group is still in.
Right.
They're going to respond to that. They see you restoring the systems. If they still have access when the internet connectivity is restored, they're just going to destroy things again. So very complicated decisions to make with the leadership in those organizations, with the safety personnel, with the experts on that industrial system, and with my colleagues and peers in forensics and intelligence.
Okay, this sounds incredibly challenging. So these organizations, I know that they vary in terms of maturity and skill sets and technologies, but generally speaking, if you had to pick like, top three, top five, what are the things that you think they could do better to enable you to do your job easier? Like what, when you walk in, what are the things you wish or you hope they have ready for you or the capabilities that they have for you to use to actually make your life easier to help them?
Start with the basics. There's a white paper out through SANS called the 5 Critical Controls for Industrial Cybersecurity, and they name things like basic architectural controls, vulnerability management, remote access control, having some fundamental incident response plan, and some fundamental security monitoring and logging. And those are things that you build on to over time. You start with the very basic elements of those five capacities and start with something. Give me something to work with. Give me anything. Give me some logging. Give me some architectural diagram, some asset inventory, some idea of how your environment is connected to remote access. Anything helps. If I don't have those foundational details at the beginning of one of these very critical response efforts, I have to go find that stuff. And that's time in these. I was talking about how important time is when you're talking about restoring a perhaps crippled industrial environment. Time is crucial, and you don't want me at incident response rates having to build you a network map. And so think about those very foundational things like understanding your environment, building some segmentation in it, doing some logging, some monitoring, having some plan of what you'll do if you do see something nefarious. Anything is better than nothing there.
Excellent. Okay, that's fantastic advice. Totally agree. Well, in general, I mean, the critical infrastructure organizations, OT organizations, and I'm going to generalize this just globally because I know you and I both work on a global scale. Which sectors do you think are leading or lagging in general? I'm kind of curious to get your take.
Yeah, so it usually has to directly equate to the funding of the organizations. So it's not necessarily related to the size of the organizations either. It's how much money they spend on IT and cybersecurity. So the ones that have the most money for cybersecurity, the best resources, are usually like the large oil and gas firms and some of the very large electric utilities. There's some legislative pressure there to do cybersecurity, and they also have money. And they're willing to invest that money, that margin on cybersecurity, on preventative controls. So they generally in the range of things are doing better. And then you have like municipal utilities that are also doing very important things, like making sure we have safe drinking water and our toilets flush and garbage goes away and transportation works, our traffic lights work. And a lot of those are very underfunded organizations in general. They're small municipal organizations. They maybe have one or two IT people, and things are much, much more challenging there. Things are prioritized in terms of keeping the water running instead of, spending money on margins of things for cybersecurity. So that's one of the scariest spaces for people who work professionally in this field. If you're talking about like manufacturing, even like big manufacturing firms oftentimes have big problems with industrial cybersecurity because of the low margins. Even though they can make a lot of profit and be very large companies, they don't tend to invest as much in IT because that's not green dollars coming in. That's an expense. That's a cost center. So we see problems there as well. This is generalizations, though. I mean, we see variation in organization size and global locations in those various industries. And the thing I do want to express is that spending a bunch of money and having a bunch of people in your cybersecurity program is good, but it's not necessarily a complete defense against intrusions. I respond to incidents and those in organizations too. They have their own challenges, but in general, the industries that concern most of us, and I don't know if you agree with this, municipal utilities, things like water, sewage, any power that's handled by a small co-op, things like that, those are scary spaces that do really important stuff and don't have many resources for cybersecurity.
Yeah, I would generally agree. And I would also say the same, where I've seen very large organizations that have spent lots of money on a wide range of tools, and they've got even multiple divisions within a security department, and they still suffer from, in some cases, fundamental issues. Where I've seen some smaller organizations, even in some of these co-ops, for example, that they've got just a superstar one or two people that can do an amazing job with limited tool sets. So
The people matter there, and the investment from senior leadership and how much they care about cybersecurity and stand behind those people. And in general, sometimes you can be more agile as a small organization. So don't feel defeated if you are that small organization. You have potential to do really interesting things too.
yeah, absolutely. Now, in these sectors, like I agree, I've seen a lot in the electric sector, a lot in the oil and gas space as well. They do have generally deeper pockets. I would see them definitely leading, especially in front of water utilities, even in some cases like rail and manufacturing and shipping, mining. Yeah. Now, which just globally, I wanted to bring a little bit of a global aspect. Which areas do you see are more advanced or further along, shall I say? I hate using the word mature or advanced, but I guess further along on their security journey, than other areas.
Well, I mentioned like oil and gas tends to be very, very well resourced. They have a lot to protect, and they've invested a lot in their IT programs and in their cybersecurity programs, and they're willing to have larger margins in these things that aren't direct income. So so that's usually one where cybersecurity is quite strong. Again, there's still problems there when you have that large of an organization. And oil and gas tends to be very distributed operations with a lot of different facilities, remote facilities that make cybersecurity very challenging. When you're talking about like platforms out in the ocean, that's a tough one. That's a really hard thing to secure. But they tend to do quite a bit better. When we're talking about like electric utilities, that depends on how they're regulated and organized in different parts of the world, whether they're centralized, whether they're a bunch of different companies, whether they're small co-ops, if there's a lot of like independent generation, smart grids, et cetera, that changes things. But in general, beyond those verticals, it tends to be the organizations that have good management buy-in and a willingness to have that cost center of cybersecurity that put organizations ahead of other organizations.
Okay. Yeah. And I'm even thinking in terms of a global perspective, like in some cases it's been regulatory driven, and in other places it's been market driven. So I've seen situations where, oh, let's say higher threat locations obviously go for a higher security profile, right? And then there's other areas where just the regulation in that region or that country have caused the whatever sector to do more. In the US, of course, we have NERC-CIP for the electric sector. We have the TSA pipeline security directives for our gas space. There's been talk about the water sector. In Europe, they have more of a general approach overall with the NIS2. And then, of course, each individual member state has their own I almost direct in some cases specific to state things like German BSI or UK has a framework like the CAF, Australia has their own CSF. Any of those that you see are really kind of, I guess, becoming more of the standard to which others should look to, I guess, is the best way to ask the question.
I think that there's a lot of good things coming out of Europe and the US and Australia. I'm always a very cautious person on critical infrastructure cybersecurity regulation, and I'll tell you why. It's because oftentimes I see two problems. The first one is that it's very strategic, and it doesn't actually provide tactical details. So strategic in terms of who owns what, who's in charge of what, and very, very high level directives that can be interpreted in a lot of different ways. And I understand why they do that because there's so much variety and variation and debate about how to do a lot of these things. But I do wonder about the efficacy in some of those cases where it's just very, very high level and strategic. But the bigger concern to me is when things are regulated without providing resources to do them. Again, thinking back to
Yes.
like those small municipal utilities, those water utilities, they got one IT person, maybe half an IT person, maybe they're an operator the other half of their time. And you're going to tell them to do a bunch of installing EDR or patching or installing elaborate network controls, that's going to take away from something else. Have you thought about what that's going to take away from? Is that going to stop them from doing monitoring? Is it going to stop them from responding to trouble tickets from the operators who see stuff happening? What is that going to take away from if you don't give them tools and actual functional resources to do that cybersecurity? So anytime I see regulation like that come into play, I also want to see at least good educational resources being provided to those utilities. More preferential would be giving them monetary resources, incident response resources, tooling, licenses for tooling to do things that you're legislating. This stuff is expensive. It's hard to do. OT cybersecurity is hard and it costs money. And again, if you're regulating stuff, that money and those people are coming from somewhere, so be very cautious about that. But in general, I mean, to answer your question, there's a lot of good ideas in that legislation. They are reaching out to industry, they're reaching out to specialists in the field in most of those countries, and they're thinking about, again, those kinds of critical control things like, gosh, we really need to control remote access. We really need to make sure that we understand vulnerabilities in these environments. We really need to segment. Yeah, that's all really important stuff. But again, doing that is not easy. You think it's hard in enterprise, it's really hard in a legacy industrial environment that you can't shut down. So, a lot of considerations to go into that. And I wish there's a little bit more tactical recommendations and resources coming out from those countries too.
Yeah, I have the joy of having written regulation and then enforced it, so I've seen what it looks like on the other side too. It's really difficult to write regulation in a tactical way because technology moves so fast and threat actors change their tactics so quickly. So you're basically forced to write it strategically. It's a difficult balance. But one thing I am seeing on a regular basis, I would say commonly through much of the regulation that leans into the critical infrastructure spaces in OT and our world, is a definitely a push for good incident response. One of the things I've debated with Danielle Chaplansky on a previous podcast was if you had to write one regulation, if you just had the capability to write one, what would it be? And we both kind of circled around the concepts of just incident response or just threat hunting. I see how they kind of go both hand in hand, but I have seen this as such a common thread through a lot of these different regulations across multiple countries and regions. And when I ask those that are writing it or influencing it, it seems to come down to the fact that there, of course, many companies will not report an incident upstream, right, to any federal agency or to the news or to anywhere, basically, other than even to their shareholders in some cases. It just, if it only goes up and out to the places it absolutely must. So given that, we've got a really bad and patchwork and misleading set of actuarial data. So we know that if Leslie eats, bacon cheeseburgers every day and never exercises, watches TV and is extremely sedentary, there's a chance that you're going to die by 40. But we know this because of the actuarial data we have on humans and healthcare for like, arguably 1,000 years from. We have, in some cases, not only, none, but misleading data in this space. And this is what they're trying to do is what's working and what's not, what's actually being effective and what isn't. So these regulations, when I ask about them, this is what they're trying to get to is how do we get this information? So barring, asking and getting inconsistent, well, as a euphemism, inconsistent answers, regulation and forcing it out of them is pretty much the only way. So that's where we're seeing a lot of this incident response regulation or standardization in some cases around it. So do you think this is even a good idea given what you do? This is your world and you do this every day. So is this something they can do? Is this a good idea? Is this useful for the regulatory bodies?
I'll start with for the audience. I do this every day. I am an incident responder for industrial systems. I am busy enough, and I have been for the last 7 years at Dragos, that this is what I do every day. There is a lot more going on in the industrial incident space than people see on the news. And all the things that you described are true. Nobody wants to have a big eye incident. They don't want to report it to their board. They don't want to have to report it to regulators. They don't want to get dinged for whatever they think they were responsible for in the intrusion, even if they weren't. And so that really is a thing. There is a resistance to reporting incidents when there's no regulatory requirement. We do track those incidents. We have our own numbers, not with customers named, obviously, but just general to what types of incidents are happening and how many per year. And yeah, I mean, that's important information. That's important information to track adversary activity, to understand what threat groups are doing, what criminal groups are doing, and how people are adapting their techniques to attack, especially lower level industrial systems, which is happening too. Now, the other side of that, though, is a lot of stuff is not being detected in time. And there's a few different reasons for that in industrial environments. First of all, the security maturity is so low. There is a lack of detection tooling. There is a lack of host tools, network tools, antivirus, EDR, smart firewalls, things that we are very dependent on in our security operations centers are only trained on these days, don't exist in a lot of levels of the industrial environments. So picking up things is hard. Oftentimes it takes somebody at a system seeing something weird happening or something actually breaking, or something visible like a ransomware pop-up, something like that, to detect things, and that can happen quite late. And there's a built-in temptation because of the poor relationship oftentimes between cybersecurity and these OT environments that do their own thing for a multitude of reasons to just swap out boxes when something weird happens, troubleshoot it like it's a equipment failure and not a cybersecurity issue. So we don't know how many things are just being swept under the rug because systems aren't monitored, or when they have problems, when they're infected past the point of no return or an adversary destroys them, they just get swapped out by the vendor or the people on site because that's what they do. And you can talk about incident reporting, but if nobody ever detects anything, things aren't going to get reported anyway. And if they are massively de-incentivized to detect anything, they aren't going to ever detect anything because they're not going to install any more detection controls. So you mentioned having a debate previously about detection versus having incident response as the primary capability, and they're both important. Like, they go hand in hand. Like, right. I don't have a horse in that race. Like, you have to have something to do if you detect something. It can be very minimal. And to be able to do something, do incident response and report anything, you have to have some kind of detection. They're both essential. They're both critical controls in the five critical controls for industrial cybersecurity. You have to start a little bit on both of those and slowly build both of them up over time. But yeah, if you just build an incident response plan, there's a lot of organizations out there with some kind of OT incident response plan. Maybe it's never been tested, that have zero detection, and they're never going to detect anything. Because when somebody perhaps gets horribly injured in a critical incident that was perhaps caused by somebody tampering with their environment, they're just going to treat it as an equipment failure. The vendor's going to swap out all the equipment, and nobody's ever going to know that it was a cyber attack. So culture is really important there. Building a strong, healthy culture between OT operators, vendors, OEMs and cybersecurity firms, agencies, et cetera, is really important. And then making sure as we're building that legislation, we're putting a focus on both of those things, both having some capability to actually do investigations, make cybersecurity part of root cause analysis, do detection in those environments, even in a very rudimentary way, and have some plan to do incident response so you know there's an incident going on and you can report it. All that stuff, it's cyclical. It's dependent on one another. You can't pull one of those elements out, unfortunately. But the trick is just starting with the very basics in each of those things.
Excellent. Yep, you summed it up right there. That was fantastic. So if they're going to mandate incident response reporting, and this, in some cases, even when I talk to the regulators who are writing this stuff, they assume that there is the capability for detection. They assume that there is the capability for all the things that feed into the incident response capacity, because you can't respond effectively if you don't have this other information. So they try to, I would say, imply that you need these other capacities in order to do incident response. So they do this in a lot of ways by saying you must have these minimum components that you report. And that, you know, kind of tacitly or indirectly says that you must have the capability to detect these things in order to provide this information in your incident response report. So they kind of get to it through that roundabout way versus directly mandating that you have detection capabilities, for example. If they were going to do that, what do you think would be the most useful minimum set of things that they need to know?
You have to understand your environment, which is more challenging than people expect. I know that, again, the cybersecurity people coming from the enterprise side of things are like, yeah, sure, I just go into my asset inventory software and it tells me based on agents what computers I have. It's really easy. That's not the case in OT. Like, what computers do you have? What do they do? Who owns them? Where do their logs go? A lot of that stuff has to be figured out on paper in OT environments, and it's really, really tough. So I highly recommend starting there, having a foundational knowledge of your environment, your logging, remote access. That's another really tough one. How are things connected? Those are all tough things to understand. And then what things mean in your OT environment? That's the hardest bit. Okay, so a lot of organizations get to the point of actually being able to do security monitoring, and they have some knowledge of the environment. They stick their SOC on it. They get their security personnel to start looking at logs from that environment, and they have no idea what anything means, because they don't have a good relationship, again, with the OT personnel, and they don't have anybody to ask. And weird stuff comes out of those devices. Like, it's a totally different set of protocols, and the domain is different. The devices are different. There's older systems, and you don't know what any of it means. You can establish something of baseline, but something's changed doesn't tell you a lot. So I recommend job shadowing programs. I think that's a really, really important thing. If you're going to build a healthy cybersecurity program for OT, I highly recommend that you implement some kind of job shadowing for your cybersecurity personnel to spend time in the OT environment, understand how people work there and how the system works, and just build a good relationship to ask those types of questions. Like, what does this mean? What's going on here? Is this bad? That kind of stuff is going to help you a lot at those beginning stages.
Okay, that's super useful. Yeah, and when I look at, like, for example, NERCSIP or CERCIA, and even the NIST2, it doesn't have a lot of specifics that you have to report. But I look at what they're asking for, and I'm just wondering, is that enough for them to really, it sounds like they're just really grasping.
Oh, like incident details?
Like
what happened in the case?
Yeah.
I mean, anything is helpful there. It depends
like
on the level
of
investigation.
Affected.
Yeah. What vertical was it? How many systems? How many systems is going to depend a lot on how flat your network is in a lot of cases.
And how much you know about how many of them were actually hit.
And what security controls you have in place, whether you have some security controls that prevented lateral movement. But more relevantly, you know, there's fundamental threat intelligence data there. Do you know which adversary group it was, potentially by any name, by any organization's identifier? What were their tactics across MITRE attack? That's useful. What parts of the kill chain did you forensically analyze and identify, so we can track that in somebody else's environment? IOCs are important. All of that information can be useful to peers, and to tracking these adversary groups at a national level. If you're talking about regulation, you're talking about what's useful for like intelligence agencies to understand what other countries are doing to our critical infrastructure or to other friendly nations' critical infrastructure. So all of that tactical detail is useful, but I wouldn't make all of it obligatory because people don't always have the maturity to get all that information. You might see one little piece of MITRE ATT&CK. You might see one little piece of the cyber kill chain. You might just know that a system was tampered with and have no other details, and that's still important to know.
Yeah, I've been advising that less is more. Just notification of incident in some cases would even be enough that they're having a problem. Because while I would love to have that rich data set you just described, some of them have never even heard of the MITRE ATT&CK
You can't really
framework.
legislate that. You can't require it. They don't have the capability to provide it. You could provide suggestions. Again, when I'm talking about more tactical details in some of this documentation, I'm talking about cross references to supplemental documentation, not necessarily obligating people to do it as part of the regulation. But again, those resources, those supplemental resources to help people do stuff, when things are very high level and vague, they can feel very overwhelming for a less mature organization. So if you're going to say you have to have an incident response plan, then gosh darn it, maybe we should start having government sanctioned templates out there for various types of playbooks and incident response plans in OT, because the enterprise ones don't work. So,
That would be tremendously useful. Maybe one of our agencies like CISA or even MITRE can produce something like that for us.
Maybe.
Yeah, we could certainly ask. We know some people. Okay. And then the next piece on these is not just what is reported, but the time frame. So what, I mean, you've done so many of these. What do you think is realistic for, any, again, generally speaking, and I know I understand it widely varies, but generally speaking, is 72 hours enough time? Is, I mean, because NERC-SIP says an hour after you notice an impact
Actually,
to
you
your
notice that
operations.
things going on. The sad reality is, okay, so let's say an adversary uses a system as a test bed. Maybe they pick a little co-op and they want to test one of their future attacks against a big city. So they pick somewhere they think is less defended, and this happens, this is the real thing. And they test their attack on them. So there is a impact. It's successful. It does something bad. It has a process impact. What are the things that happen early on in the first day of that? Well, first of all, the operator and the engineers try to figure out, troubleshoot what's going on. They try to fix it themselves. And then when they can't do that, they call in their OEM. And maybe then the vendor has to get called in by the OEM because the OEM can't figure out what's going on. And then we've got the iffy situation where maybe they just swap out the box because they can't figure out what's going on, or maybe they call their cybersecurity team because they think it's so weird and they want them to be part of root cause analysis. So how long has that taken? I mean, that could have taken days of troubleshooting, of getting the vendor to go out to the site. They have to get in to dispatch somebody. They have to get in their car. Then they decide that it's they called out an engineer and the engineer couldn't fix it, and then they called out the OEM. The OEM couldn't fix it. Then they called out the vendor. So I mean, I don't want to let people take more time than's necessary, but understand that there's time involved in troubleshooting OT stuff. Now, if it's ransomware, if it's like, you see some mouse moving on the screen, that's quite visible, although there is going to be troubleshooting involved in that too. An engineer is going to have to call somebody, and they're going to have to call somebody, but it's not going to happen fast. I'm getting called in 6 months after incidents. I'm getting called in 6 years after incidents. Like it's a slow process right now because of that lack of detection and incident response maturity I talked about. It's a really slow process for people to figure out it's a cyber thing and get somebody involved who knows what to do with that. So I don't have an answer to the question. Like, 72 hours. If it's ransomware, yeah. If it's something that's visibly cyber, yeah. But don't expect that's going to happen when it's actually the big bad doing something to a process. It's not going to happen that fast.
I've often said the more advanced the adversary, the longer it's going to take for them to notice it's an actual incident.
That
So,
it's
and
actually
those are the ones you're
cyber.
actually trying to solve.
And that's the really scary stuff because they're making the same thing happen as a dangerously failed piece of equipment. So it's going to look like a dangerously failed piece of equipment.
Well, it's good to know that even someone who does this every day doesn't have a good answer
No,
or a
I wish
comfortable
you did.
answer anyway. I know.
Maybe an actuary does or something. Maybe looking at the incident metrics, you could come up with a number, but it takes a long time, and that's a big problem that we have to solve first.
It's super challenging. No, I couldn't agree more. But I didn't expect anything different, to be
Yeah.
honest. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, the last one I wanted to discuss is the definition of incident, because rarely is this well defined. Do you have something you use, or is this just as squishy for you as it is everybody else?
So, definition of how you qualify one,
What
you
an
mean?
incident means, yeah.
Yeah. I would still use the standard cybersecurity definition of incident. It's a major event, but how you quantify a major event, a cyber event in your environment is going to depend on what matters to you in your industrial environment. And this is something that everybody misses in OT as well. They usually copy their severity matrix over from enterprise, and it's absolutely goofy and ineffective for OT. Your severity matrix in OT, what you quantify as a high, medium, low severity audit level incident or event in OT is going to depend on what makes people get hurt. That's the worst day ever is how I usually explain this to people, is what you really need to do is you need to sit down with your leadership and say, what is our worst day ever? What is our worst case scenario as a industrial business or an organization that relies on industrial systems? Is it somebody dying? Is our process failing for 24 hours? A worst case scenario is our really expensive equipment being utterly destroyed, a worst case scenario. And then you work down from there and figure out, well, what could practically cause that and what mitigations for those hazards are in place, because you don't want that to happen because an operator screws up. So there's safety controls in place. They're not all digital safety controls. Some of them are physical, some of them are human. So you have to do that kind of risk mapping down from actual consequences you actually care about. What would really cause the worst case scenarios? And those are your high and critical level incidents. And that's going to vary depending on your industrial environment, your process, your vertical, your location, et cetera, your redundancy. All of those things are going to play into that calculation. So you've got to do that for your industrial environment. And that's how you name what an incident is, what a high severity incident is versus a audit level event that isn't actually considered an incident to a moderate severity incident, et cetera. You can't just say, oh, a web server compromise. That can't be in your severity matrix for OT. It can't be, oh, there's 40 computers infected. Does that actually matter? Like if they're infected with Conficker or Sality? No, shutting down the process to reimage those computers is going to have a much worse impact from a consequence perspective. If it's ransomware and there's a loss of control, that's a very, very different situation. And you should be calling out like a loss of control, loss of visibility situation, not, oh my God, we've got 40 computers infected with malware. I've been called into environments that have been infected for 10 years and they finally have a big enough maintenance outage and upgrade period to get rid of it. So they're calling me in 10 years later. Like consequences are king there.
I would say that I've been to generation plants and they're just rife with Conficker and no one cares
They're
because
all
it's just not
infected.
impacting anything.
They're all infected. Yeah, you can't think about things like that.
Now, th there are some that argue that it doesn't qualify as an incident unless there is malicious intent. What are your thoughts
Oh
on
my God. I don't care. I don't care. Define
that?
incidents however the hell you want. Like, I see them defined differently in every industrial org because they define words differently between IT and OT. Sometimes OT defines incident as, something independent of malicious activity. Yes, I understand in enterprise environments, we usually clearly define cybersecurity incidents as things that have malicious intent involved, but in OT, sometimes you've already defined the big I incident as anything that impacts the process. So I don't care. I'm sorry. That's my answer. My old curmudgeonly answer to that is figure out your definition, share it with OT, make sure you're on the same page with definitions, and make sure you've quantified how you're going to define those incidents at different severities very, very clearly in a way that actually makes industrial and process and safety sense.
Yeah, no, and I totally agree. I understand. The reason I was asking was it matters when you're trying to report both upstream within the organization for incident management metrics or KPIs, in addition to outwardly to insurance firms, or
Figure it out.
whether you're going through M&A or a regulatory agency, for example. So, yeah.
Figure it the hell out. Decide whether that's going to be a differentiator for that and how that figures into your regulation. That's the only answer I'll give there is make sure you have a clear, common, shared definition that everybody knows and makes sense for making people stay alive.
Yeah, I'm just still waiting to see what that clear definition
Yeah,
looks
we
like
all are.
for any
I
of them.
mean, I don't think that they're going to include malicious intent in regulation for
Not for
avoiding
OG.
incidents. I haven't seen it in a lot of places globally for that type of legislation and regulation for reporting. I haven't seen that requirement for it to be purposefully malicious activity.
Yeah, it's not in like NIS2, for example, but
No.
if you get to the NERC SIP standards, they actually have a clause in there
Yeah.
that says attempts to compromise. And that one seems to lean into the malicious intent space a
Attempt
little
to
bit, but.
compromise is the worm that's just headless and spreading in your environment and doing bad stuff unintentionally. Is it attempting to compromise systems? Gosh,
I know.
semantics. Like,
That's the fantastic
is
debate.
Sality getting on something today? Attempting to compromise? I don't know. I don't
Right.
know. It's
No.
ambiguity again.
Yep. Seems to be the crux of the argument. When you have those situations that really do, you know, they look like, I mean, they would qualify as an event or a cybersecurity incident, but you don't have that malicious intent or that attempt to compromise. So it's one of those things. I just thought it would be interesting
It's
to
an
ask someone who does this
interesting
every
thing
day
to
their
think
thoughts.
about. You know, again, make sure that you have a common standard definition. And if you are a regulator, make sure that your definition for other people who need to report to you is clearly defined. Like, and based on what you want to know about, if you're the regulator, do you want to know every time somebody deals with Conficker? Do you want to know about that? Is that useful to you? It has real impacts in environments. It can eat up low resource machines and cause really weird, bad things to happen in industrial environments. But like we discussed earlier, pretty much everybody has old headless worms in their critical infrastructure environment. So do you want to know about everyone? Then you're going to need to define that. You're going to need to say that in your regulation.
Yeah, and then you're gonna have to house all that data, and in some
Yeah.
cases, try to make
Uh,
use
that's
of it
it.
all.
That's a
So,
them problem. That's definitely a them problem there.
yeah,
Yeah,
the other side of that
figure
one
that
becomes
out.
more challenging.
Define
Cool.
it clearly. Don't make these ambiguous definitions. You have to make things clear for people.
Yeah, do the hard work to actually get it defined right.
Yep.
Awesome. Okay, well, I'm gonna wrap up with asking you, what is next for Pancakes? What's going on?
I guess personally, I am currently making an endeavor to move to Australia with Dragos
Awesome.
and start working on a new frontier of industrial operations and incident response there in that region of the world. So there's a lot of development and growth in incident response there, and I hope that that works out. I'm very excited to start working in Australia and the nearby nations in defending their critical infrastructure as well. So that's what's next for me, hopefully.
Okay, fantastic. I really hope that works out because I know you'd
Yeah.
be a valuable resource anywhere you go. So I certainly
Thank
hope
you.
that
You're so
happens.
kind. This was so
You
fun.
bet. Yeah. Now, are you going to any of the conferences that we usually see you at coming up? So in case anybody's listening, they can catch you.
I will be at ShmooCon. I'll be at Chai BurrCon in Chicago. I will be speaking in Canada a little bit later in the winter time, and I don't know beyond that. Right now my plans are a little bit up in the air based on when I'm going to move, but I'm always trying to find opportunities to speak and participate in conferences, so I'm sure I will, whatever continent I'm on that month.
Fantastic. Okay, and I will put all of your contact info in the show notes so that people can find you and contact
Oh.
with you and get much, much more of your valuable information.
Oh, you're so kind.
Well, Leslie, I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
It was such a pleasure. Thank you for the really thought-provoking questions.
Thanks for listening to the AmpIx Cyber Critical Assets Podcast. You can find us on all your favorite podcast sources, so please like, subscribe, and share with your colleagues. Check out our other content, such as blogs, news, and more at ampixcyber.com. That's ampyxcyber.com. Ampix Cyber, securing your world.